When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, today's guest is bassist and lead vocalist, Kenny Vasoli, from the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania pop-punk band, The Starting Line. Together, we dive deep into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the Billboard Modern Rock chart hit single, Island, taken from their 2007 album, Direction. Once again, worlds collide here on Krista Makes a Podcast, as Kenny and I share numerous stories about the producer of this song and record, Howard Benson. The band were young and hungry, but weren't quite ready for the change out of the gate that Howard presented them with, like chopping up their songs through editing, his overall recording approach and studio team, and bringing in session musicians. Some of these were hard pills to swallow, but ultimately Kenny feels like it made them a better band overall. The demo for Island was pretty close to what ended up being on the recording, except they needed a chorus, and the musical interlude they came up with after the demo is pure genius. Oh, and the band has pretty much had the same lineup since 1999. Bands are a complicated animal, so this is no small feat to accomplish. So for all this and a whole lot more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast.
Kenny, how's it going?
Good, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Where are you this afternoon?
So I'm in a suburb of Philadelphia. Willow Grove is like kind of the closest place off the turnpike that people would know about.
Yeah, you guys are Philly guys, right?
Yeah, for the most part. Everybody was just sort of in the suburbs like surrounding Philadelphia. Like I was in a place called Horsham. Tom was in a place called Croydon. And then, yeah, Matt lived in Churchville and Mike was in a place called Southampton. It was all like Bucks, Montgomery County, just like 20 minutes from Philadelphia. What about you? Are you Florida right now? Or are you elsewhere?
No, I live in the Knoxville, Tennessee area. Yeah,
oh, cool.
I'm not in Florida anymore. Yeah, we only have two guys in Florida now. Everyone's spread out. So
sick. That's how it goes.
That is how it goes. But you know, something that I thought was really, really cool. You know, I research the song, and of course, the song we're talking about today is Island from your third record. But in researching you guys, something that's totally admirable and very, very difficult to do. Four of you guys have been with the band since 99. Original guys. You on bass and lead vocals, Matt on rhythm guitar, Mike on lead guitar, and Tom on the drums. And the new guy, Brian, on keyboards, he's been there since 2007. So that's a feat in and of itself. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And just to give Brian his flowers, he's pretty much been there since 2005 as well as like a touring member. He just started to appear on the records in 07. But yeah, we feel very lucky and I feel grateful. We kind of just weathered the storm with each other's like developing personalities, and we were even so just playing shows this weekend and sort of talking about that. Like we feel very lucky to have found ourselves on the other side of, you know, growing up, and it's a very comfortable thing to be with the same guys since then.
Yeah, I got 3 out of 5 right now, and our sax player has been with us since about the time you guys started, around 2000. But there's nothing, you know, when you go see a band, to have as many original players as you can, and the fact that you guys are all still together, that's great.
Oh, thanks, man. And 3 out of 5 ain't bad.
Three out of five ain't bad. I think it sounds like a Meatloaf song. I gotta tell you, not gonna go into the whole backstory, but you guys signed with Drive Thru. That was your first label. And around the time I knew Richard and Stephanie Raines, they were just signing bands left and right. It was like every other week, it was you guys, Newfound Glory, Hidden in Plain View, Early November, Phoenix TX, on and on. But the quality of the bands that they were signing, every time they'd be like, this band's the greatest in the world. I'm like, okay, well, you've had a pretty good run here. And then you guys at some point were that next band. And it was like they were putting out quality stuff. And next thing I know, you guys were doing, you know, all the Warped Tours and everything else. And it kind of got you into that scene.
Yeah, that was definitely instrumental in us finding our lane. The drive-thru thing was always, you know, that was always a place where we saw ourselves really fitting in ever since we started the band. It was, you know, it seemed like it was right in the path of the sound that we were really interested in. And but it also had an accessibility and a DIY kind of nature to it. Like, we knew that they started it out of their garage and we really respected that. And we also knew that they were Jersey folks, which was the place we seemed to be getting the most response as like a grassroots, you know, like starting out kind of band. And so it was a great fit for us. And especially at the time where they seemed to have the peak of their powers, so to speak, it was a blessed time for sure.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit because, you know, and I've talked about it on this show many times about that scene. That Jersey scene was just so fertile around the time you guys were coming up. Even for Less Than Jake a couple years earlier than you guys, we'd go through there and there was always multiple places to play. VFW halls, churches, backyard parties. And, you know, that was another thing for us. When we got up there, it was a whole different world. We didn't really see that in Florida.
Yeah, Jersey was a really exception for the type of music that we were playing. Because even in 99, 2000, when we started up, there wasn't a whole lot of bands to sort of cozy up with that had a similar sound to us. There was maybe one or two that we found in the area, but for the most part, it seemed like Jersey was, for whatever reason, kind of finding this sound that was still a little bit aggressive and a little bit fast, but was veering more towards the melodic side of things. And so once we started getting on some shows at like the firehouses and Elks Lodges and all that sort of scene in Jersey, we really started to, I feel like, find some fans, and that's where we sort of gained steam.
I remember doing like 5, 6, 7 shows in Jersey, and we'd be working our way down the East Coast, and they'd all be VFW DIY type shows, and then they would all go off. There'd be like 100, 200, 300 kids going berserk. And then we'd get down to like Richmond, Virginia, the next stop. And it was like, the brakes just came on, you know? So we actually very early on felt like our band was something because of the scene in Jersey.
Yeah, I can definitely identify with that. We maybe had like a warped mentality of how successful we were by, you know, the response that we were getting in Jersey. And then like yeah. Our first tour, we were like, okay, this is how you really grind. And you got to do that for a while. But yeah, even from those early years, even till present day, we still feel the love in Jersey, and it's been kind of ever strong. And it's been pretty amazing for us, like, to play places like Starland and still get like relatively wild reactions for how long we've been doing this and for how little kind of activity we've put out.
Well, that's the thing. I mentioned a little bit ago about the backstory. I wasn't going to go into the whole thing. You know, you guys did a record with Drive Through. And the next record was on Geffen, the major label debut. And then from there, you went right to Virgin. You weren't happy with that deal. And the record on Virgin, your third full-length album, Direction, was released July 31st of 2007. And Island is on that record. It was your band's lone charting single, peaking at number 21 on the Billboard Modern Rock chart. The album peaked at number 30 on the Billboard 200 chart. Island was track 4 out of 12, so it wasn't buried. Did you kind of think that there was maybe something here with this song? That's why it was front loaded on the record?
I don't know how much calculation went into the sequencing of it. I think that, yeah, it was definitely being groomed as a single even before we laid it down. So we were prepared for that treatment of it. And I guess that was probably the mentality of keeping it on the A side. Yeah. And I think probably in general, that record is kind of front loaded with the potential like Usual Suspect type singles. And then the back half was sort of like our record to play with.
And lots of parallels. Again, this has happened on a number of episodes here on the show because the album was produced by Howard Benson, which Less Than Jake has much history with Howard. You guys recorded at Bay 7 Studios out in Valley Village and Sparky Dark Studio in Calabasas. Howard's place is out there with engineer Mike Plotnikoff, who's just absolutely amazing, and Hatch, the engineer, who's can't say enough about him. But what was that like, and how did you decide on Howard to do the third record?
Okay, so it's a pretty involved long story with our relationship and saga with Howard. And to be honest, this is sort of the most exciting and intriguing parts of being able to do this podcast with you, because I knew that you did Hella Rock View with him. And that was actually a big reason that we trusted him with us. It was like that, you know, that we first of all, it seemed like such a strange pairing to us that that record was made with him. It's like sort of an anomaly. Mm-hmm. And also it just sounds so fantastic that it's sort of undeniable. And so that, you know, just gave us this like seed of doubt, like, you know, maybe there is more to this guy than meets the eye and is like on the surface of his discography. And yeah, so I actually tried to hold off listening to your episode with Howard because I wanted to sort of dig in on our own. But I'm glad that I did, because it gave me a lot of insight to his background and how he sort of found his way with you guys. And also, I could go into that episode for a long time, but it really was, I think it was a good prep for this.
Yeah, and I had Nick recently on from All American Rejects, and they recorded with Howard. And so we spent probably 10 minutes just talking about Howard's sweatpants and Oreo cookies. So,
oh my God.
Feel free to go for it.
I just know that the topic of and character of Howard Benson is going to dominate a lot of this conversation, just because he is just such a fascinating guy. He is absolutely one of a kind. And and I should just go into this like whole conversation saying, like, I have absolutely nothing but admiration and love for this individual. Like, truly, I think he's one of the great rock producers of our time.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But you know, I might say some things along the course of this conversation that would like make people think otherwise, but I truly admire the man fully.
Well, he is set in his ways. He is very sure of himself, not in a cocky way. He knows his stuff, but he's a little crazy, and you kind of have to be to be in his position. Did it help that he's a Philly guy?
100%. And I don't even think we knew that until meeting him. Like, we assumed he was like an LA born and bred kind of guy, because he was just so ingrained in that sound. I had no idea. And I think that maybe that was probably one of the reasons he was entertaining the idea of us. Cause like, it was sort of strange. Like, we were not, you know, even though we had been on Geffen and had like a little bit of success, I don't know. It wasn't like producers were knocking down our door, at least not in the way that Howard was. Like, Howard was really courting us for some reason. And we had worked together on Based on a True Story for two songs. Like at the end of the bulk of working on Based on a True Story, our sophomore record, we were kind of, you know, us and the label were a little bit feeling like there was a little bit more that needed to be done with the singles. And we wanted to try to recut them with like another producer or two. And so we ended up going with Howard Benson because I think we were impressed with the sound of the My Chem record and a few other things, and had worked with him at Bay 7, like kind of in the same fashion that we did Island, and really loved it. And then when we were working on one other track at Trax East in Jersey with Eric Rachel, the opening track, Making Love to the Camera, we were there in the studio and we got sent the first mixes for the Based on a True Story Howard Benson singles. And we were like really put off by how much editing had happened after we left the studio. They had kind of almost been unrecognizable in the way that they were returned to us, just like a whole lot of liberties taking flying things around and just like,
yeah,
really kind of, in my opinion, messing with the composition of the song in a way that I didn't like sign off on. And it was just kind of like, are you guys cool with this? And it wasn't like we were cool with it. Like it was a lot of like note passing and stuff to even get that to across the plate. So it was off to a precarious, you know, sort of relationship with him, because like, I really did enjoy tracking with him. But then afterwards, I felt like this sort of like violation of trust, like, oh, I don't know. You know, this guy is sort of like doing a little bit of funny business in the edit that, you know, now I have to like kind of fight to get my, you know, song the way that I want it to sound. And it was like an uphill battle. So
sure.
It was, yeah, like he was almost sort of cast out of our mind as even a possibility as a producer for the future. And so when it was getting
interesting,
yeah, when it was getting discussed again, everyone kept mentioning him, like saying like Howard really wants to do this record. Like he really loves you guys. He loves working with you guys. And we were just like, I don't know, like he was a little shady with the last one. And then, so we went out to dinner with him, and this was the real like clinching conversation. And he was so straight up with me. He was like, yes, I did that to your songs. Yes, I'll probably do that again to your singles. But here's the thing. I'm going to let you guys have the rest of the record to do absolutely whatever you want with. And I'm going to be upfront with you, as upfront as possible, with the changes that I'm making. But just expect it. Expect that I'm going to still be this guy that's going to mess with the stuff and edit because what I do. And I think that it's for the best. But the rest of the record, you guys can like just basically have run of the asylum and like just go as nuts as you want. And I was like, you know, that's a fair deal. And I like that he's owning up to everything.
Yeah,
and
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was just very upfront. And I was just sort of like, you know what? The rest of the band really likes him. The rest of the label likes him. And I really like this honesty that he's giving me. So I'm going to trust him with the record. And at the end of the day, I'm really glad that I did, because it's honestly my favorite Starting Line full length. I think that it was the easiest record for us to cut. And he was definitely the guy for the job.
Yeah, well, it was recorded, I'm assuming, probably sometime early 2007, because the album was released at the end of July that year. It still sounds absolutely amazing 16 years later. It sounds great. It sounds like it could be current, something out on the radio. And Howard, you know, at least you guys signed off on knowing what you were getting. He was upfront and honest. When we made our second record with him in 2006, or 2005, it came out in 06. And that was an eternity from where Howard came from when we first worked with him on Hello Rockview.
Yeah.
He was a no-name producer. Sepultura was his first act. We were his second act. This is after he had his 80s heyday. He wasn't getting phone calls returned. He was looked at as a has-been. Next thing you know, he's got POD, My Chem, and then it just went through the roof. By the time he got to you guys, he was pretty seasoned and had a great track record with getting on radio. And I think, you know, there's something about owning what you do as a producer in terms of, you know, he said, hey, let me have the two or three singles here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm owning this. If they fail, you know, if they don't do what we all wanted to do, then that's on me. You guys can have the rest of the record. So again, you knew what you guys were getting in with.
Totally. He just asked for that trust in the singles. And we were just agreeing to give that to him because, you know, I think that he, you know, it's like you said, like he knows what he does and he plays to his strengths, and that he just asks for, you know, trust when it comes to that. And going into it, I was just a lot more comfortable with that notion.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I want to get into the track here in a second. Do you remember writing it? Was it specific for this record?
Yes. I don't really remember the beginning of writing it. You know, I remember we were sort of in the midst of a batch of songs when we were, you know, in the basement, just sort of grinding it out for this record. And I knew that we were feeling this one. This was not an obvious single to us at all in its first form, because it didn't have the chorus that we know today. And I actually didn't think it had one at all until a few weeks ago in preparation for this. Our keyboard player, Brian, sent me the demo from when we were tracking in the basement, and it was crazy sounding. I mean, it sounded a lot more like something off of Based on a True Story. It had the same verses, essentially. I think they were, for the most part, longer. The second verse was definitely doubled, and the chorus was this like switching to 3-4 time kind of thing. So it was like a little mathier, and it had like this like 3-4 swing kind of thing to it. And it was like, I don't know, it felt like we were trying a little bit to make like an At the Drive-In song or something. Like it was just a little bit more bombastic, like start and stop, not really worrying too much about like writing a pop song. It seemed like we were like a little bit more like the lead off song direction, just trying to do something that was like angular and like a little bit post-rock or post-punk or something. I'm gonna treat you right. If I get upset, get off of your chest, find me misguided young man. I will get back to that place that I left, and I will stay right here in your care. I think it was our call that we knew that the chorus was not holding water. Even by the time we got to pre-production with Howard, like we flagged it with him. Like we even cut out that first demo chorus before he heard it. And we put in what is now the pre-chorus. And so, and we can sort of get to all this because I know you're going to break it down, but like that was all we had was just verse and pre-chorus. And we knew that we didn't have a chorus yet. And we told him that it's sort of like to be determined.
And I'll tell you something, you know, I don't know if I ever brought this up on the show before, but 3 years into this thing, I just got to thinking how amazing, you know, sometimes you do a song and you don't realize at the time, like, again, this is probably just another song when you were writing it, but it's all the components of, you know, getting it to Howard and the changes it went through, but it's always the chorus. I've never had a band in here, an artist say, yeah, well, we had this great chorus, but we had no verses. No, it's always, we're missing the key hook of this track. What is it? But to your point, the pre-chorus of this song, it does have a chorus quality to it.
Yeah, we know, like, we were sort of like, this is better than what we had for sure, but we were still like, it just doesn't feel like a chorus. And then, and even that pre-chorus was doubled at the time to sort of fill that gap. But so when we went to Howard with our pre-production and we just sort of like played for him in a rehearsal space all through the songs, and then we got to that one, you know, we've, even before playing it, said it doesn't have a chorus yet, we know. And then after we played it, he said, yeah, it doesn't have a chorus, but that's your single and you're going to want to write a chorus for that one. And so I was like, okay, that's cool. That was kind of the first time that we really felt like, oh shit, maybe there is actually something to this more than meets the eye for us. And I was like, okay, I'd love to work on this, but we're, you know, on the other side of the country from our home. Like, I don't have an acoustic guitar out here. Is it okay if I just borrow one of the studio's acoustics? And he was just like, dude, just go to Guitar Center and just buy a guitar and just give us the receipt and it's yours. And my mind was fucking blown. I was like, no way. Like, I get to just have a guitar because for making this record. And he was always that kind of spirit. Like, I'd never worked with a producer before that was just like, yeah, dude, we have a budget, man. Like, use it. And I got to say, I had not seen the budget for this record until 3 days ago because I was looking for, we'll get to it, but there was a version that was like rough mix version before Chris Lord-Alge got a hands of it. And we'll get there. But I was trying to get that. And our manager sent me everything. He didn't have that, but he sent me everything else he had, which was just a folder of like all the documents and sort of like lodging and demos and like even producer ideas, like stuff I had not seen or like thought about since then. And I won't reveal the budget of this record, but holy fucking shit, man.
Yeah.
It's so much more than I thought it was. And so it makes sense that they were like, yeah, you can have a guitar. You can have a $600 guitar.
Absolutely. In 2007, that was right near the end of labels throwing money at bands. It really was.
Yeah.
Streaming was becoming a thing and the whole industry was changing. But let's get into the song. It's 3 minutes and 42 seconds. We got a two-bar intro, drums, single bass notes, and stereo octave guitars on the first bar. And also stereo guitar stabs, big distorted stabs with those bass note hits on bar two. This, to me, is the hook of the song, Kenny. It's one of the big hooks. And I don't know if this is a keyboard or a keyboard and a guitar, like a chorus pedal flanger effect maybe mixed together that take us into verse one. Do you recall if that is a keyboard?
That's a keyboard. That's Brian's hook right there. And in our first version, there was a lot more of that. It was sort of just like a revolving that dun, 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 mm-hmm. dun. Yeah, and I know that like he plays like a like Wurlitzer sounding module pretty much the majority of the time. And so Benson would take like his MIDI, and he had a really nice sounding MIDI Wurlitzer. I think it was called Velvet, if I remember correctly. It was gorgeous. And then I remember he would like pair that with other just like crazy, probably like Omnichord type sounds. And there is a little bit more of like Benson's keyboard magic in there, but that particular lick is Schmutz. And that was like, that's honestly like his charm to the band. He's just able to like put these like sweet little hooks that are just like understated, but very nice.
Well, and that, you know, going back earlier, what you were talking about of getting a song and having it changed around for some of the listeners that maybe didn't get the gist of that. That's kind of like what may have happened here with Brian's key parts. You know, Howard would take that key part and he might run it through another synthesizer and bury it back here and do stuff. Though it's those little nuances and stuff that Howard does. He's a mad scientist. And that's what makes these hit records, all these little components.
Absolutely. I really think that, I mean, that sort of thing is the magic that happened between Howard and us. Like, I think that we were sort of a perfect kind of clay for him to put his hands on sonically, because we did like have aggressive tones, but we also had deep pop roots to our sound. And he was like unsuspectingly really good at melody and like very intelligent pop melody. Like I remember he showed me some idea that he had for Reliant K's record. And I don't remember what the song was exactly, but it was sort of this like modulating, shifting, like several key change, like Beach Boys type thing. That was like, he said like, oh yeah, that was my thing right there. And that became really evident. Like he was sort of really good. Like, and especially when it came to like building harmonies, you could just tell like he really had more of a knack for pop than what you would believe on the surface.
Oh yeah. I mean, when his band would pack up in the 70s and the bars in Philly and, you know, and go out partying, you know, Howard was still there geeking out on his keyboard sounds. I mean, true story. He was that guy. He's the first composer we ever worked with, and having that knowledge, you know, I don't read music. My music education is very rudimentary, and Howard came in and I was a young kid on Hello Rockview, and the stuff that he taught me is forever priceless. I gotta ask, Kenny, is this a hi-hat? Is it like a programmed loop that's running under this song mixed in with real drums? That's what it sounds like.
Okay, so the drum track in itself is sort of a whole saga, and we can start to get into it now, but I guess we should just sort of like say it that like we cut this whole song and it had different drum groove for the verse. And I, from what I can remember, the chorus drum groove was essentially the same, that disco, you know, like double time, yes, hi-hat, like four on the floor. Mm-hmm. That all that I think was there, but we had what was true to the original demo, like this groove that was sort of, it didn't have snares on the two and four. It had like anticipating and snares. So it was like, let's see. So it wasn't, you know, like it didn't have that straightforward thing.
Gotcha.
And it was never an issue the whole time that we were there. And then so it got Bensonized after I left, and they did not ask like if I was cool with changing the beat. They just brought in Kenny Arnoff to recut the drums for the whole thing. And then so they just sort of like asked forgiveness after they did that. And it was like, honestly, probably weeks of like negotiation between the label and Benson and I, like just trying to like, I was fighting so hard to like get it back to this original version, because I've come to terms with it and I've like definitely found peace with the drums as they are today, because like I understand what they had in mind to make it more listener friendly and to make it more straightforward.
Hey, don't feel bad. Every band that's on a major,
yeah,
most every band has gone through this.
Yeah,
they have. There's a reason why Kenny Aronoff plays on hit records. It's because there's a swing. You can tell someone what to do. It doesn't take the sting away from what you're talking about.
Right.
I've had it happen. I've handed my guitar over. Usually it was to Roger to play parts.
Right.
You know, certain things. He just played cleaner. And I said, here, at the end of the day, in my mind, I always knew that I'd be the guy on stage playing it. It wasn't going to be Kenny Aronoff playing the drums or whoever. So that always got me through that, but still a hard pill to swallow as a younger band.
Definitely. I was for sure at the sort of the most stubborn that I had been with the band as far as what I wanted to accomplish with records. Because, I mean, to me, it wasn't about like the promotion of records or like how well they even charted. Like I never knew what they charted on, you know, Rock Billboard until today. It just didn't matter to me, because like, I know at the end of the day, like that stuff can be so fleeting. I've seen enough of the bands that are our contemporaries, sure, that have success. And then 6 months later, you know, people can barely remember who they are. So I knew that that wasn't really like, did not mean success. And I was much more like had the long view of like, I have to play this every night. So I want it to be something that I love. And if it's something that I really don't love, then I'm going to fight for it to be something that I love. And especially, yeah, when, yeah, it's something that like, we are all there, you know, we're all talking about this at great length. And then, you know, like if he at that, you know, like during, you know, those weeks of sessions was like, I really don't think that this like drum groove is like where it's at. I would have been 100% receptive to it. It's the thing of like having this guy that played the drums on this song that's very important to me. And I've never met the gentleman before, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't want to talk shit on Arnoff. Like I know that he's a greatly accomplished drummer and like completely, you know, decorated with like tons of awards and has been on like so many iconic recordings. Like, so not taking anything away from him, but at the same time, like I got to give Tom his flowers. Like Tom is our drummer and, you know, like Tom is kind of our Ringo. I feel like he has this imperfection about his playing that is actually really charming to me. And the sort of like thing that broke me to the side of like, let them have it, let them have this the way that they want it and let it, you know, let it exist, just play ball with it, was that Tom was totally cool with it. You know, like he had enough like security within himself to know like this is what's best for the band and everybody.
Yeah, team player.
Felt
team
that
player.
Way. Yeah, everyone was being a team player except for me because I felt like, fuck, this is my song and I don't want to fucking it to be something that it, yeah. that other than what's in my brain. And, you know, there's just sometimes you like, you have to pick your battles and I was really like fighting it for a while. And then once everybody else was just sort of like so comfortable with it, then I just sort of had to give it up. And I truly have come to terms with it, but it's something that is still a little bit of like a sore spot just because I don't know. It just doesn't feel great the way they went about it.
Sure. And I don't think I can't speak for Howard, but if I were to bet, it wasn't diabolical. I think a lot of times, how many times have you done this? I'll be sitting, it'll be 2 a.m. I'm about to turn my studio stuff off and it finally hits me. Now I know why this song's not hitting me in the heart. It's because that drum on the 2 and 4 is not there.
Yeah.
You know, and it could, and then all of a sudden you get, now going about it the way they did behind your back. Yeah, that sucks. But again, it's awesome that Tom was a team player. He's the drummer. And again, he's still there.
Totally. Fucking A. And he plays yeah. it, you know, he plays that part. Like it's something that he's got to play every night. So honestly, like what, if it makes him comfortable, then like, honestly, it's his call.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome.
It's a nuanced thing for me, I think, that is like really the thing that's most unsettling. Because when you're talking about that, like, is it, you know, like a program thing? It sounds that way, I think, because we weren't able to play to the drums. And that's just something that as a bass player is very important to me. Like that is like
sure.
the core of the pocket is for the bass being able to being glued deliberately to the drums. And if it's not, it just feels a little bit out of place, but you know, it is what it is. And I think that when it's something as quantized and sort of on the grid as that song was, I think that it's pretty forgivable for the ear, but you know, now everyone knows.
Hey everybody, we got to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, but we'll be right back with lots more with Kenny Vasoli.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
And now, back to the show.
Verse one here is a double verse. And I, you know, the beginning of this song, I almost wondered the first couple of times listening to it, why that keyboard hook didn't go through more. And now I immediately knew why after verse one,
yeah.
because it happens a lot, okay? But it's good. It is one of the big hooks of the song. But we got a double verse here on verse one, same instrumentation as the intro. Let's sail away. Let's sail away, find our own country. We'll build a house and beds out of palm trees. Let's get away. Let's push our lives aside. I'll sport a smile, take in some color. Under the stars, I'll be your lover. With no distractions, I'm gonna treat you right.
So this song was about a relationship that it was my first ever long-term relationship. You know, we had been together since I was, I mean, on and off, but mainly on and since I was like 16 years old. And at this point, I'm like probably 22, 23 when I'm making this record. I think, probably just turned 23. And we had, you know, been going through a rough patch, as you can probably, you know, gather from the lyrics. And we were actually just coming off a breakup and we were still kind of sort of broken up at that point. But now I was in LA and that was, you know, her home city. And we were sort of rekindling at that time. And it was just sort of like an idealistic song about like, you know, maybe if we just didn't have any distractions of life, that maybe this could actually be like smooth sailing for us. And that was just sort of the idea of it. Like, I was just trying to sort of like, at that time, get back on her good graces, because I felt like probably pretty lonely after the breakup. And we were, you know, I probably should like bite my tongue a little bit. I don't want to get too personal about the relationship between her and I, because it's, you know, we haven't spoken for a long time. Not that there's bad blood, but I'll leave it a little bit more like ambiguous. But
understood.
Yeah, generally, it's about, you know, just trying to like get through the rough patches of a relationship that is quite imperfect and thinking idealistically, if there was nothing else but her and I, that like this could somehow all be okay. But I mean, it was all over for good, like within the year after that. So it was like, I mean, there was like, you can sort of tell like my mindset at that time that I'm like, just like grasping at straws to try to like make this thing work, which I'm sure, you know, people can identify with.
But hey, isn't that amazing? We get our best known songs out of pain and misery.
Yeah.
rarely do they come out of sunshine and palm trees, as the lyrics indicate here.
For sure. Yeah.
100%. At Let's Push Our Lives Aside, we get a two-bar reintro. That keyboard lick, the first time is the same as the intro, but on the second bar, Kenny, the lick changes two notes on the back half.
Yeah, it has a little extra tag.
It just makes it super hooky, those two notes. Do you remember if that was Brian or if that was Howard or how that came about?
If I'm going off of the logic of the first demo, I think that it was always that full hook with the extra two notes. And then it was either in the session between Howard and Brian or Howard's editing that he probably chopped off those notes. And then, you know, even like, I mean, that lick happened probably three times as much as it does in this final version from the demo. So I imagine there was just a lot of like, let's do this less and then let's see what it happens if we just scale it back more and more and save up the full lick.
It took me a couple times listening through to go, why is it different on the second one? And it was only two notes. And it finally hit me. It's like, duh.
Yeah.
But I love it. I think it's such a great hook. At the very end here, before we go into pre-chorus one, we get another two-bar reintro with that keyboard hook leading us into pre-chorus one. Right. You know, listening back to the song, right after you say with no distractions, I'm going to treat you right, you could have went right into the pre-chorus right there. Do you recall having that conversation? We got to bring back the keyboard hook because now it's the third time in the song you've heard it.
There weren't a lot of conversations about the keyboard parts. The way that Howard works, and I don't know if this was the same for you, but he was recording this like a factory. You know, like he would,
oh yeah,
he would do drums. And that was sort of the drums were the part of it that we were the most together. After that, we pretty much didn't see each other until like dinner time, because while Mike was finishing guitars, like once a song was done, he would just send it up to vocals.
Yes.
And then I would just start like cutting vocals. And then we would maybe do like, but we would already have like scratch bass. So we would just do things sort of like staggered in different rooms all at the same time. So everything went very quickly. And so someone may have been recording with Brian even as I was recording vocals. And then, you know, things just sort of happened very quickly. Things got edited like on the fly, but like things like that, he would play them for me and like, how do you like this? Like, how's this sound to you? And like when, you know, we'll get to the middle eight part, you know, like parts that were new to me.
I keep using the term hook, yeah. But there's a reason why that keyboard part's there. It's part haunting. It's catchy.
Yeah.
And otherwise it wouldn't have been there. You would have went right into pre-chorus one, but let's get into these lyrics here and talk about these. Well, it seems like things are only getting better. Well, it seems like we can never catch a break.
That was the like original chorus. And so that was sort of like, that was to me just like the actual final thought and the sort of like core subject of the whole thing. But then, yeah, it was sort of like an unresolved thing. It needed to sort of have a little bit more explanation and a little bit more hopefulness to it.
I like the ambiguity of it. Well, it seems like things are only getting better. And then the very next line is, well, it seems like we can never catch a break.
Like, totally. It just always, you know, when it seems like we have it all figured out, then the other shoe would always seem to drop.
Gotcha. Well, here's a Howard thing. And I don't know if you had ever done this before, but there's a really cool lower octave vocal. It's the first time we hear double voices in the song. Is that you ghosting yourself?
Yes.
It is you. Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. It's not a harmony. It's just an octave.
Uh-huh.
It's really cool. It's subtle. It's not mixed super loud. The stereo guitars and bass guitar are still here playing stabs for the most part. Halfway through, there's a killer bass run. I love the bass tone on this as well.
Oh,
it's such
you.
A great bass run.
Things are only getting better. Well, it seems like we can never.
And there is a new arpeggiated guitar part running through this whole pre-chorus. And that part adds such a great tension to this part before the chorus launches.
Hell yeah. I love, you know, like start and stop things. Like that was the big charm to me for this song before we had the choruses. Like I like the start and stop thing that was sort of like, sounded like a more pop, like Refused idea or something. And then also, you know, like Jimmy Eat World's Futures was big on just like big, chunky, loud, you know, block guitars with really pretty perpetuating either arpeggios or just sort of pedaling happening underneath. And we were definitely inspired by that kind of sound.
Yeah, it's got like a post-punk hardcore thing about those gents, those stops. It's cool. Chorus one comes quick. And there's a lot of song here already. I was surprised how quick this came. At 48 seconds, we're into the chorus.
Just keep a hold on me to let go. If you float away, if you float away. Waiting too long for a ship to come. Don't you float away, don't you float away.
Just to keep a hold on me, don't let go. If you float away, if you float away. Waiting too long for a ship to come. Don't you float away. Don't you float away. The first time the stereo guitars and bass guitars are continuously playing in the song. They're not staccato doing djinjins. You know, besides the octaves that were going earlier, the whole band is continuously playing here. It totally opens up. There's also another jangly arpeggiated guitar throughout the chorus. And I think I'm hearing a synth running underneath, maybe some pads there. Would that be correct?
Yes, for sure. I think, yeah, Schmutz had his keyboard parts, and then I'm sure that he probably blended his whirly with some organ or something like that. There was some wizardry happening in the MIDI there.
And by the way, Brian might have the coolest name in rock and roll, Brian Schmutz.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't get much better. Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that.
And just to speak on what you're talking about, how he has like these like sort of haunting, but very like melodic
poppy
and hooky things.
Yeah.
So that was 100% what always attracted me to him. He was in this band in like the mid-90s when I first met him called Inkling. And they were like, sort of Deftones were kind of the closest thing to it that were in existence at the time. But to me, it was like Thursday, you know, like 4 years before Thursday even were around. Like he was just this, he always had this like really strange, dark pop sensibility to him. And it just always attracted me to the music that he made. And I'm so glad that we linked up. And ever since he and I started, you know, collaborating together, like he always has these like little perfect things that just like that has a great knack for it.
Well, these are also the first harmonies in the song. They come on the second and fourth line, "Float Away, If You Float Away." And then we get into verse two, immediately from chorus one into verse two. We don't get the keyboard hook here. Hey, let's go to bed. Let's stop debating. Look at the time. We're always waiting, but we're in love, and that should be just fine. You don't have a reintro here, just goes right into it because I think it was front loaded in that double verse.
Yeah. I cannot breathe when we play this song live. I just gotta say that. And like, I wish that there was like, this is by far the hardest song for us to sing in the set list. It's top of the range and no breaths.
I had Keith from Every Time I Die on the song that we did. He doesn't stop singing for 3.5 minutes. And I even said to him, I said, you know, do you think about now when you're in the studio not to make this mistake again? Because some of our early songs, same thing. I can't hardly do them live.
Yeah. And so this chorus too, like this was the like bring the guitar home from Guitar Center and just like work for the weekend and like get the chorus down, like playing around with it and then stumbled across those four chords. And then I knew that this shit was going to be at the top of my range, but it just sounded so good. Like when I did hit that high note, if I could like really get to it, just filled up the room really nice. I did not calculate how difficult it would be because the verse is quite, you know, like at the ceiling of my range as well.
It's awesome though. I love how it goes up there, that octave. It just makes that chorus lift. And this is a true chorus that it sounds like you guys were missing on that demo. Again, immediately into verse two from chorus one, let's go to bed. Let's stop debating. Look at the time. We're always waiting, but we're in love. And that should be just fine.
Yeah, it's all pretty much like just the same thing. Like, and that verse was a lot longer at first, which I forgot about until hearing the demo. And it's got like some pretty cringy lines that I'm glad we got rid of. It's like, you know, like we're not relating and things like this. It's just like, oh my God, it's just too much of that rhyme happening. And I think
those are
I just,
my lyrics.
No, man, not at all. I've definitely gotten better at editing over the years, and I've definitely, from hearing the demo, like picked the best, like pared it down.
Self restraint and editing is the best tool of any musician. Yes, and I still struggle with both. Something really interesting here, and I'm wondering if this is a Howard thing. There's two triangle. It sounds like a little bell, ding.
Yes.
Little triangle. It's on the word bed, and it's right before debating. Go to bed. Let's stop debating. It almost sounds like a clock, like a ding on an alarm clock or something. I'm wondering why it wasn't on the next line. Look at the time, ding. There's no ding there. It's only on the first two lines. How did that happen?
I think that that's probably just the way that it's mixed, because the guy, Lenny Castro, who did the percussion on all the songs on that record,
did he do it? In my notes, it says Louis Conti, because I've met both of those guys.
Oh.
Was it Louis or was it Lenny?
Oh, I wonder. I just am going off of... Man, you could have it right.
I'm going off Wikipedia, which has lied to me many, many times in the past, Kenny.
Man, I feel totally embarrassed that I don't know this gentleman's name by heart. I am going off of the budget sheet. They had it for Lenny Castro. So that's the only way I got that name.
Those are the two guys in LA, Lenny or Luis Conti. So either one of those guys, it doesn't matter. But and I can't wait till we talk about the bridge part, because what's going on there is rad.
Oh, I mean, I was mystified during the percussion session. I was just like completely jaw to the floor, like just eating it up the entire time. And from what I remember, he just cycled through that triangle the entire song. And then it probably was just like a mix decision thing of where it appeared.
Okay, because I can only, if it's there, I can only hear it the first two times. On the last line, and that should be just fine, the keyboard hook returns for two bars. You get the changing notes at the second pass there. Before we get into pre-chorus two. And that should be just fine. Same lyrics here as pre-chorus one. You got that cooler, lower octave vocal happening. And again, I swear I hear the triangle here in pre-chorus two, but sporadically. It doesn't follow a ding, ding, yeah, ding. It's just like, it's just kind of there in different spots. And I'm going, and then I would rewind it, listen to it again, and I'd swear I'd hear it in different spots. It was really messing with my head.
Yeah. You know, I tried to, at my hardest to be present for the mixes with Chris Lord Alge. Like I was, and I, this was like when I was really first starting to get into producing as well. So I really wanted to, you know, I was like, I worked on this record. Like he's got to let some artists in the room when he mixes. And he was like, yeah. You come on down. You can be present for mixing. And what they do is they just like sort of put me in like the waiting area with all the cookies and they let me smoke my weed and like watch TV. And they're like, all right, so I'll get the mix going and then I'll bring it in here and you can hear it. And I didn't get to see anything that he did. But I imagine that's the, probably that's like him just riding the faders and like feeling it like when he wanted to.
And there is so much liberty, especially guys like Chris Lord Alge, some of your famous mixers, they get liberty with this stuff. You know, hey, you know, do a pass. And I want it exactly what it is. And then sometimes a producer will say to them, do a pass, but add some of your Lord Alge flair there. And they'll start kicking things around and doing stuff. It's interesting how that happens. But I love that it's sporadic. I think it's really cool. We go immediately into chorus two here. We get a double chorus this time. Just keep a hold on me, don't let go. If you float away, if you float away, we need too long for a ship to come. Don't you float away, don't you float away. Just keep a hold on me, don't let go. If you float away. The lyrics are exactly the same both times. The harmony placement's the same. Was that ever a discussion? Hey, we should change up this chorus here, or even the end of the song. I noticed the lyrics are all the same.
Not for me. I always sort of like to keep it as simple as I can because I do, when I am left to have some room with that stuff, I do maybe take it like further than it needs to be. Like I sometimes complicate things to a fault, you know, and songs like this, I feel like, you know, there's bands like Weezer where it's just like there, it doesn't feel like it should change up. Or if it does a little bit on the last one, that's great. But simplicity was something that, especially on this record, I try to play into our strength of simplicity. And and you know, like I feel like where it does change up is just those like sort of ad libs that he asked me to throw in there, which I've never even really tried before. Like Benson was basically like just try to do like kind of soul singer ad libs for the backgrounds, and then I just like could kind of just put whatever lines I wanted to, whether nonsensical or not. But I wasn't too concerned with getting a variation on the lyrics.
Something I didn't mention in chorus one is there acoustic guitars here in the chorus is ghosting. I'm hearing a percussiveness to the strumming here, and I'm wondering if there's acoustic an acoustic there buried back somewhere.
Yeah, I'd have to listen to it, but that seems like something that we would have done on this one. We were layering quite a few guitars, but I wasn't always there for guitars. So
it really seemed evident on chorus two. I went back to chorus one and I thought I heard it there too. It could be pushed back.
Sounds right.
On the second half here, after the line, just keep a hold on me, don't let go. You get a backing vocal kind of panned off left, slightly left of don't let go. This backing kind of like a call and response. There's also a vocal pad, these stacks of ahs that are kind of buried here on the second half. They're there. They're audible, but they're not sticking out too much. But man, it just adds such a great depth to the second half of this chorus.
Yes. Yeah. It was so fun cutting vocals with Howard. I get sort of neurotic when I'm working with a producer the first time with vocals because it's a very vulnerable thing to be doing.
Oh,
you know, especially like when you're not always feeling your best, you know, you always try to relax as much as you can and give your best performance. But I know that this guy's worked on serious records. So he really, I think one of my favorite aspects of working with him is just the ease of getting my vocals with him. Like I couldn't believe how wonderful my vocals were sounding. And I also asked him at the beginning of it, before we started anything, to please not tune any of my vocals, which we'll see, you know, like I know that he likes to tune vocals. So I'm sure that like he maybe took it with a grain of salt, but it doesn't sound terribly tuned to me. Which I respect how much of the natural, you know, kind of imperfection he leaves in there.
I mean, you can also sing. That's the thing.
I try.
Roger and I learned how to sing because of Hello Rock View. Howard built that song. He tuned everything. It was like, whoa, we have to pull this off.
I was really surprised to hear that because, I mean, especially for the first kind of version of Auto-Tune, I thought that that sounded really natural. My ear is pretty sensitive to it.
Well, yeah, the horns sound awfully auto-tuned. That was the first version. We were like one of the first records ever to use auto-tune.
Yeah.
But yeah, the vocals not too bad. Again, Roger and I could sing. It's just we had to learn how to sing where Howard crafted the parts. I'd do a pass or two of the verse, he'd say, hey, on the last pass here, kind of just do something different. What do you mean? I don't know, just kind of be more aggressive. And then I do it, and he'd go, okay, we're moving to the next section. I'd be like, but wait a second, I didn't get that. He's like, I got everything. Let's move on.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you had that same sort of sensation of ease working with him on vocals?
I did, but he also whipped me when I needed it.
Right.
And I needed it as a young singer.
That's good.
I've always been very receptive to producers. I've at least wanted to listen to them.
Yeah.
And I've at least tried everything that they've wanted me to do. I may not have agreed with it. I might have thought it was stupid, but I would go along with it. And it made me a better singer, for sure. Bottom line.
Definitely. He has this way of encouraging too, that was very nice. You know, that not every producer has this sort of bedside manner where he is able to like really give you compliments in a way that is like, you know, not gassing you up, but also like it makes you feel like relaxed and, you know, is when you're doing something that he really likes, he's very good at pinpointing it.
Well, out of chorus two, we get a dramatic scene change. This musical, 8-bar musical interlude, I'm calling it, before the bridge, it's a single synth note that's holding out for all 8 bars. As another synth, kind of like a flute sound, is playing a moving part. There's congas here, it sounds like, sporadic, maybe a timpani drum, and tambourine panned left and right, kind of doing this shuffle thing. It is so awesome. It reminds me almost like of a Spielberg flick with like some Latin festival in Miami. It's like a party, this part.
When we got to this section, it was blank, I think, for a while. It was pretty much just the guitar kind of doing its thing. And then I got to hear their percussion idea once they came in and they just went crazy on that part. But the keys was all Benson, and he just told me, I have something here. Just trust me. I'm bringing it home. I'll send it to you. It's going to be crazy. Just trust me. And I was like, okay, man. Like, I at this point, he had complete trust with that kind of stuff. I just knew that he was going to, like, take it to the place where it needed to go, and he totally did. There was zero notes when I got that back. And I think that it's like a synth oboe or something with some sort of processing
okay.
through it. I believe okay. that's what the instrument is. That's at least how we refer to it. And it is bonkers.
Was there a timpani in there? Do you remember? Like a big timpani drum?
Think,
that's what it sounds.
Yeah, that boom. I think it might be. I think that might be right.
And the thing about this part, and I've talked about this in the show before, did you or anybody in the band go, man, this should almost be its own song, this part, you know? And I've done that before. I've wasted a great set of chords and melodies on a bridge. It's like, well, wait a second. Like, am I wasting this here? Because that part is just so cool.
Oh, thank you. Well, so much labor had been put into this song that we were just like trying to get it across the finish line.
Cause get it done.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, we had invested so much time into this, especially for being a single. Like, typically when we start to put so much thought and time into a song, we sort of gild the lily and the song doesn't really land most of the time. It seems like it just gets overcooked or something. And I'm really grateful that it didn't happen with this song. Like, we were still able to, like, you know, harness what was good about it and get it across the plate.
Well, my next favorite part comes right after, and it's the bridge. It's a double bridge. And this bridge is so interesting because the first time you sing it lower down an octave and then you reach the second time. And I listened to this part a bunch. I'm going, why is this is lifting? But, you know, typically bridges don't run through the same lyrics two times.
Right.
And it totally works here with the way you did the vocal delivery.
And if you like some other time, I would like to introduce you to the finer things. If we survive, get out alive, I'd like to say how beautiful I think you are. And if you like
And if you like some other time, I would like to introduce you to the finer things. If we survive, get out alive. I'd like to say how beautiful I think you are. The first time you get that in, you get R in there. The band comes back in here with new, slightly overdriven stereo guitars, and they're doing this chugging pattern. It's a different sound and a different feel there. Those jigga jigga jigga, those guitars. It's awesome.
Oh yeah. Well, you're talking about Hatch and Mike, and those guys were just absolutely crushers with guitar tones and getting everything. Like, I mean, those guys were basically, for Mike with the guitar, what Howard was for me for vocals. Like, they were just turning them out so quick. Like, I remember just playing video games so much of the time during that record because things were happening so fast and there just frankly wasn't like enough work for us to do. Everybody was just so good at getting the performances that they needed.
Their studio is like a conveyor belt.
Yep,
you know,
exactly.
You're in here working on guitars, a guy's over here working on vocals, and someone else is editing drums in another room. That's all going on simultaneously. And that's why those guys can kick out records as quickly as they do. They're not spending 6 months on a record like it was back in the day going to tape. It took that long to get these majorly produced, great sounding commercial records. Again, the vocal first time here is ghosted with a higher unison vocal. It's not a harmony. The second time, the higher vocal is now the lead. That's where it lifts there with call and response backing vocals. On the first line, it's an if you like and if you like, and then if we survive, you get those backing vocal call and responses. And there's harmonies on lines 3 and 6. I would like to introduce you to the finer things, and I'd like to say how beautiful I think you are. You get some harmonies there. The last time, I'd like to say how beautiful I think. You don't get the R there because this big snare fill comes in with this noisy guitar-like noise that launches us in to chorus 3, which this chorus goes 2.5 times.
Yeah.
It's not quite a double here. Again, we get the same lyrics here all the time. On the first line, you get "Don't Let It Go," a backing vocal.
Yeah.
And there's some new single piano notes that come in here on the second half of chorus 3. The second half, we get those vocal ahs. Those pads come back in. And as the song's fading out, when another round of chorus vocals start on the fade out, there's a new keyboard at the very end. It sounds like single notes on a Rhodes keyboard. That happened there. And it's so cool to just have that little bit of something extra as the song's fading out. Do you remember that happening?
No, that must have happened in Brian's session while I was simultaneously doing vocals. But I would imagine that's probably Benson hearing that in the same sort of way that he hears backup vocals and probably just asked, you know, Brian to throw in some stabs there.
Now, you guys, you've done very well for yourselves. You got a lot of great, great pop songs. What is it about this track? Why did this one bubble to the top with your fan base? What do you think it is?
I don't know. I was actually really pleasantly surprised to hear that you picked this song. I mean, I'm glad we did, especially because of the Benson ties. But I actually had never really considered it like much of a fan favorite, even you know, regardless of it being a single. We even sort of didn't necessarily play it at every show for a lot of our active touring period. Yeah, because like, I honestly, people weren't really crying about us not playing it. Other people were, you know, had attachments to the older stuff, which as they do sometimes.
Interesting.
So, and okay. Now it has like grown to be, you know, somewhat of a favorite, but it's not like, It does not set the crowd on fire, you know, like some of the, even the deeper cuts do. So I don't know, but I do think that it's one of our best songs, and I think it's probably our best single. So, and I'm really proud of it. I think it stands alone as a unique song in our catalog. And it, you know, feels like it walks this line of like having some Talking Heads and like LCD Sound System influence that, you know, was definitely penetrating at the time. And I'm glad it came through because, you know, like we are sort of like, you know, color inside the lines a lot of the times for our sound. So this was maybe the furthest we were able to experiment with a pop single and to do it in an effective way. I'm really happy with that. And I'm happy that we sort of like reclaimed ownership of the song live.
That's awesome. Well, hey, Kenny, I want to thank you for taking the time out to sit in with us. I know the listeners are gonna get a thrill out of listening to this. And before we break, is there anything you'd like to leave people with? What's going on with you in the Starting Line?
Honestly, man, this show is so fantastic. I have to give you your flowers for this. Like, not enough people give you compliments on what a gracious host you are and how eloquently you speak and ask these songs that are, I mean, like, you ask these questions about these songs, you know, like Trevor from Face to Face and Disconnected and like Milo and Hope. Like, these are songs that like this band would not exist if it had not been for these songs. And that was really what set me on the path to find the sound of this band and like to be included in that crowd and to be asked the same questions in the same way that you're asking those guys. Like, I really appreciate it, man. I find it a great honor.
Thank you so much. That is rad, man. Thank you.
Yo, thank you, man. And to answer your other question, thanks for giving me that. But Starting Line is making the rounds with All American Rejects this summer, doing a couple of dates with Andrew McMahon in a few weeks, depending on when this drops. And then I'm in a band called Vacationer, and we have new music on the horizon. So please check it out.
Well, tell the Rejects guys and Newfound I said hello this summer.
1,000%. It was so good talking with you, Chris. Thank you.
You're the only one I want, someone.
The song that you're hearing right now is Magnetism from Vacationer. If you haven't listened to Vacationer, you should do that today because they're really, really awesome. And I thought that Kenny was a really awesome guest on the podcast. And Chris and I are going to talk all about it in the rap segment that's coming up. Also, we got the band you might not know coming up right after a few words from our sponsors.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Hey everybody, Satan here. I know what you're thinking. Jesus Christ, Satan has a podcast now too? No, that's not it. But I am here to tell you about a podcast, and it's one that's all about my favorite band, Punchline. Not the band you expected me to say, right? You probably figured I'd like Slayer, or maybe some backwards Beatles records or something. Those are okay. But you usually find me rocking out to fan-favorite Punchline albums like Action or Lion while I'm torturing dead people for all of eternity. Punchline's podcast is called A Band Called Punchline, and it's super entertaining to listen to this documentary-style look back at the 25 years of my favorite band. Honestly, I'm really feeling like I'm getting to know these guys, and their story is amazing. I'm so ready for them to get down here. I have so many questions. I gotta give them credit for catching on to my whole 37 thing, too. There's a reason why they're my favorite band, and if you listen to their podcast, they might become yours, too. A band called Punchline is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Check it out, and I'll see you all in hell.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is The Pretty Flowers, a four-piece indie rock band from Los Angeles, California, comprised of Noah Green on vocals and guitar, Jake Gideon on guitar and vocals, Sam Tiger on bass and vocals, and Sean Johnson on the drums. Their brand new record, A Company Sleeve, is out now. Here's a snippet of their song, Baby Food.
They spun the truth like a top. Too much momentum to stop. They spoon-fed the truth to you. And you ate it up like baby food. What can you do?
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, I thought this was a great episode. The starting line, we played a few shows together here and there. Always thought Kenny was super cool and always really loved his voice, like the tone of his voice, his vocal quality. Always a huge fan. He's really great at writing a great pop song. And, you know, I thought it was super interesting in this episode when he described what I would call an artistic crisis. When you're in a band that achieves some sort of success, you will inevitably face at some point some sort of artistic crisis. And Chris, usually it's one of two things in my experience. Either A, it's what Kenny described, where you're in the studio and they talk about bringing in someone else to play something. And as an artist, you're like, oh man, I can't handle that. Or B, it's the situation where you're going to play on some sort of television situation where you have to pantomime playing your song. Yeah. Those are the two artistic crises that I can think of. Have you ever experienced those sort of crises? I think you alluded to that. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah. We've had it. We've had the conversations where, you know, some guys in the band didn't want to co-write and other people did want to co-write. And there's all those kinds of hiccups. I think, you know, with this, it was so funny getting into this episode because much like the episode with Nick, All American Rejects, it's like, here we are again. It's the same team at Bay 7 Studios, Howard Benson and the whole gang. And I just know how they work, and to have other guys share their experience. You know, you do sign up for these things inadvertently when you, as you said, you get to some point of success and those hiccups, they just come with it.
You got to make a decision. It's at some point you're going to be faced with a fork in the road where it's like, do I do this thing that I feel like is against my artistic integrity but might lead to more success, or do I whatever? To me, it's all silly. I think most importantly, you serve the song.
Sure.
And in this instance with this song, which I think is an incredible song, it sounds amazing, I think they made the right decision. They served the song.
Absolutely. And the drummer is always the first one to go in the studio. They're the first ones to get replaced. It's always about the groove. Your band's not going to get signed and get into the studio if your singer sucks. They're going right. Completely get that out of the, they're going to get that out of the way. Change your singer before I sign you. So rarely do you get in the studio and have to, you know, hey, we got to bring in another vocalist to do this part. It's usually the drummer. But you know what? Again, sometimes that's the cost of doing business. I think the song is the proof of what they got out of it.
It was a really interesting story how they got the mixes back from Howard from their second album where he mixed a few songs for Based on a True Story.
Yeah, a couple singles.
Yeah, and they were like kind of put off by what they got back in certain ways. But then they met with him and he was so honest that they're like, okay, we want to do this. We want to record with him. But then they're also battling kind of to a certain extent during the recording. And hey man, sometimes, it actually might have been Nick from All American Rejects episode where he said like sometimes that's where you get something great, is like having those sort of battles, you know, the resulting product is sometimes great.
Yeah, and I've known Howard long enough and other producers that think like him. You know, it's not this diabolical, methodical, you know, I'm going to go in there tomorrow and tell them their drummer stinks. It's, you know, they'll be recording a record for 2 or 3 weeks, and it's Howard sitting at home when his family goes to sleep and him listening at night, sitting there editing, where it finally hits him. Oh, the snare on the 2 and 4, it needs to be there. You know, those things. So, you know, I can sympathize with, yeah, my artistic integrity has been compromised here, but I don't think it was malicious coming from the producer's chair.
Yeah. Another thing that he said in this episode that I totally related to, and I know that my bandmates would relate to this, he said when you overcook a song sometimes, it just doesn't land. And by the time it's done, you're like, what did we do here? You spend all this time trying to make this song happen. It reminds me of Mean Girls. You're trying to make Fetch happen here. It's, just sometimes if you go too hard on a song, it just doesn't end up anywhere near where it started. And it's like the story we hear so many times in this podcast. Sometimes these songs that took 5 minutes to write, you know, that just spill out of you, end up being the most popular songs. One more thing he said that I thought was really cool and insightful was that he said that chart success is fleeting. We all know that. He's so right. Look at your band, Chris. Look at Starting Line. Look at all these bands that have these followings, you guys, for 30 years now, and you haven't had like a giant hit, but you have this cult following. You have this huge fan base. And think about how many bands have had hits that have not even 1/1000th of what you have.
I know.
You know, so it is true that that chart success is just, it's whatever. You know, it's cool. It's cool to say, I guess. And for some people, it does work out, but for most people, really doesn't.
That's right. Well, something else cool to say, Chris. For everybody out there listening, we have a supporting cast at chrisdemakes.com where you get bonus episodes each week for about the price of a cup of coffee. chrisdemakes.com. You'll be supporting the podcast that we hope you know and love right here. So thank you very much to all our members that are part of it. It's a good time. Once again, chrisdemakes.com. And give me a follow on Instagram at @LessThanChrisD. Give Chris Fafalius a follow on Instagram at Chris Fafalius. I think it's just your name, right?
It's just my name. You got to figure out how to spell it.
Exactly. That's up to you out there. And if you haven't already, please join the Chris DeMakes a Podcast Facebook group. We have a great time over there. Almost 5,000 active members. And I want to thank this week's guest, Kenny Vasoli, for sitting with us. And we'll see you next week.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.